having a stereo. I'm hysterical. I can't stop when I get like this. I can't stop. I'm hysterical. I'm wet. I'm hysterical and I'm wet.
Catapults of propaganda.
Alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I am Sharon Gilbert, everybody. And welcome to our bunker on this lovely midsummer. Oh, no, that would be first day of summer.
The longest day of the year.
Oh, boy, has it ever been. Not nearly enough hours in the day, though. It doesn't matter how long that day is.
No.
It's never long enough.
But it certainly got our share of sunshine today. A hot, steamy day here in St. Louis, which is the way it is from, and probably will be, from now until
September.
About mid-September. Yeah. So it is, well, once again, we're thankful that our bunker is below ground and nicely and naturally insulated from the heat outside.
That is so true. Now, I don't know what awaits us in Columbia, Missouri when we move there, but we're going to miss the bunker regardless of how cool and how kind and lovely
the new place happens to be.
Yes. I hope it's kind. That was an odd word to use. You move into some apartments and they just hate you right away.
You can tell.
Oh, yeah.
The walls start dripping blood and you hear these voices that didn't get out.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah. That hasn't happened here lately and we're thankful for that. Welcome back to the bunker. It is day number two of our interview with Jerry E. Smith about HAARP, the ultimate weapon of the conspiracy. He gave us an overview last night of what this gigantic radio transmitter is about, and we will continue tonight talking about what it might be used for. It is interesting that while it was started as what appeared to be a research project by the University of Alaska and the Departments of Air Force and Navy, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency took it over about 3 years ago and completed the build-out. And it went online at a full 3.6 million watts of power this spring, and we don't quite know for sure what HAARP is for.
Well, I don't know, but if it's, you know, if it's a rock station, then they may have trouble getting the demographics they really need. I think easy listening is the way to go on that.
Because the only way to get people to listen to it is by hitting them with 3.6 million watts of power so that you can pick it up on your fillings.
I know that.
In Botswana. So, we'll talk with Jerry Smith about that as our summertime conspiracy series continues. And meanwhile, boy, have we got stuff to talk about in the news again today. Not a day goes by.
You know, these people in politics, I know that they get up every morning. What can we do today that will make it to Watcher Magazine?
That's
Paul,
right.
I didn't make it on Watcher again today.
Yeah, it's Well, sometimes it's like they're not hardly even trying. But today, boy, they were really falling all over themselves to make it into the magazines, into Watcher Magazine, that is.
Because everybody wants to be in Watcher Magazine, of course.
Interesting column from David Lazarus of the San Francisco Chronicle today about AT&T, which is like the Phoenix, risen from its ashes. Yeah, risen from its ashes. You remember it was broken up by the courts some years ago into the Baby Bells. They have congealed once again, sort of like that black oil stuff in the X-Files show. You know, you could spatter it around. It would just kind of merge back together and continue to invade. AT&T has issued a new privacy policy to its user. Now, remember, AT&T absorbed or merged with the former Southwestern Bell, which had been known for as SBC until recently.
Which was a big Baby Bell.
Yeah, it was.
It was
sort of like the Baby Huey
Bell.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I doed it. And AT&T, as of Friday, which would be the 23rd of June, 2006, has adopted a privacy policy that says that your personal information, Mr. or Mrs. AT&T customer, doesn't belong to you. Your confidential personal information belongs to AT&T.
I'm just amazed that they have the cojones
Yeah.
To say that.
Why even call it a privacy policy then?
Yeah.
Our privacy policy is that any private information you give us is public.
And since we own it, we can dispense it as we please.
Exactly.
Why, we can sell it if we want to.
Yeah. What this really does is it's like, let's see, we're being sued by the Electronic Freedom Foundation for giving over all this information to the NSA. Mm-hmm. So if we put a privacy policy in effect that says we can do this, then they can't sue us the next time. And basically, this is what it boils down to. AT&T is covering its corporate assets by saying that if you want AT&T service, you must agree to let us do whatever we want with your confidential information.
It's the CYA confidential policy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that means that, it doesn't take a genius
service,
to figure out what you
need.
You're
going to have to agree to it.
Yeah, it doesn't take a genius to figure out what that means. It means that you no longer have privacy of any confidential financial or information if you're an AT&T customer, unless you want to switch real quick. Incidentally, and this is really weird, AT&T intends to track the viewing habits of subscribers to its new on-demand movie service, which is something that cable companies are prohibited from doing by law.
That's really weird.
Why do they want to know that? Well, maybe they foresee someday the NSA wanting to know what movies we're watching.
How many times have they watched Signs?
Yeah.
Or conspiracy theory,
something like that. So that is just another day in the empire.
I know. Well, I'm going to watch Catcher in the Rye later.
Speaking of conspiracy theory.
Yes?
Yes. There was a story we reported on and have been watching for a few days now that involves the disappearance and death of a publisher in Baltimore. And it appears that his death may not be according to the press releases that have been put out. The gentleman, Philip Merrill, disappeared earlier this month, and his sailboat was discovered on Chesapeake Bay with the motor still running. Now, he's 72 years old, but he's an experienced sailor. The official story is that he was depressed. He'd had heart surgery about a year ago. He was on several medications, and that he took the boat out to Chesapeake Bay, shot himself in the head with a shotgun, weighted his body down with an anchor. Presumably, he did that before he shot himself in the head, and then fell overboard. What has not been reported in the Associated Press story is that he was declared a suicide. His death was declared a suicide before the autopsy, which is a little unusual. Normally, they will check the body to make sure at an autopsy to see if there's any substances in the blood that would indicate that he'd been drugged or if there were any wounds that were inconsistent with, say, gunshot.
Why on earth would he weigh down his own body?
Well, that...
I ask that because I'm not believing this at all. So how on earth can anybody expect someone with intelligence to believe that report? Okay, I'm going to weight my body down out here in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay. I know that I am an expert, you know, yachtsman. I'm going to then shoot myself and fall overboard.
Well, that's the thing. It would seem that if you were going to kill yourself, the weighting of the body with the anchor might be considered extraneous.
The only reason to do that is so your body isn't discovered.
Or at least not discovered right away.
Right.
And the point to that is that bodies that are pulled out of the water after they've been in the water sometime tend to preserve less of the toxicological substances in the blood so that it's much more difficult to make a case for homicide in a situation like this.
You know, Chesapeake Bay is becoming quite a dumping ground.
It is. Former CIA Director William Colby went out in a canoe by himself, which was found alone. And then in 1978, CIA Deputy Director John Paisley was found, you know, floating in Chesapeake Bay.
And, of course, one, if you really wanted to stretch it, I guess, you could take in John F. Kennedy Jr., who crashed into the Chesapeake Bay.
Well, he was off Massachusetts, I thought.
Was he?
Yeah, I thought he was off Martha's Vineyard when the plane went down.
Oh, maybe he was up that far. Okay, scratch that.
But still, Chesapeake Bay is sort of like, you know, the Pine Barrens are to the Philadelphia, New York mobs.
Mm-hmm.
The intelligence agency's community wants to get rid of somebody. Chesapeake Bay is a big place, and there's lots of access points to it that are relatively hard to find. And the reason that we raised the question about Philip Merrill is that he had some pretty sensitive positions within the government. Not well known, but he was the director of the U.S. Export-Import Bank. And while he was the head of the Ex-Im Bank, the bank made some dubious loans to the Coalition Provisional Authority. Now, that was the group under Paul Bremer that kind of ran Iraq until we got their elections, you know, out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then a successor agency in Iraq called the Trade Bank of Iraq. Much of this money was supposed to facilitate exports from the United States to Iraq. But mm-hmm. in fact, this money, much of it went to contractors in Iraq. And as we know, that many of these contracts that were awarded to companies working over there were no-bid contracts that were given to companies that always seem to get the work when the government needs somebody to
How
go in.
How convenient.
Yeah, Halliburton, Bechtel, Kellogg Brown and Root, companies like that, Blackwater, and so on. In 2005, there was an audit performed by the Office of the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. And this audit found that $8.8 billion that had been given to the Coalition Provisional Authority was unaccounted for.
$8.8 billion? That's a lot of money to lose track of.
Which is still a lot less money than the Department of Defense lost. It is interestingly enough, they announced the day before 9/11 of 2001 that there were trillions that mm-hmm. couldn't be accounted for. But then, of course, you know, 9/11.
And it's less money than BCCI lost.
We
need to bring in that Merrill is reputed to be, now I can't give you documented evidence, but it is said that he was involved in the BCCI scandal in allowing the Import-Export Bank to launder some of the money.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about that is if you go back to June 13th on Watcher Magazine, we can link to this story.
Sure.
It's a story about the mastermind of the BCCI being arrested in Malta. At the same time, there was a story about Merrill disappearing. Mm-hmm. There was a story about a gentleman who supplied Irish passports to the BCCI Saudis involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And that the former head of the bank, the BCCI bank, had died, all within the space of a few days.
Right.
It seems like, and I have to bring this in, like the end of The Godfather, when all the scores are being settled, mm-hmm. as Michael Corleone stands at the altar.
Mm-hmm. And all the loose ends are being tied up, and it does kind of have that feel to it,
mm-hmm.
doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. Well, this is something we need to do more research on, because right now we're just kind of tossing facts out mm-hmm. here and giving you our impression of things, but we have to stress that we don't have any hard evidence that all of these events are connected.
Exactly.
However, since we are not coincidence theorists, we're not prepared to say that all these things are just chance.
No. No, we're not. We will link to that story, and also mm-hmm. there's a good backstory on BCCI that was on Watcher Magazine that same day.
Yes.
On June 13th. Well, let's see. All President Bush went to Vienna.
Did he get some Vienna beef hot dogs while he was
I
there?
I hope so.
Oh, wait, no, that's Chicago
that's right,
is where you
that's
get those.
That's right, Dave. You can't get those there. Yeah, he went over there, and he was discussing a lot of, well, you know, important president stuff. Because he's the decider, and he gets to decide. So he went over there, and I think Mrs. Bush got to visit some, you know, churches and things like that, while President Bush and Condi Rice did some hard work.
Yeah, that's an interesting photo that you...
I know, and I chose that intentionally. We haven't said a whole lot about this this rumor that's floating around about the two of them, but...
Yeah, and we'll just throw this out here without saying whether we give it a lot of credence or not. But there are stories that are beginning to circulate quietly around the Beltway that the president and the secretary of state are perhaps...
Closer than they're supposed to be.
Yeah, it's more than a working relationship.
Well, it's documented that she... accidentally, Freudian mm-hmm. slip, whatever you want to call it, in a meeting in front of press,
yeah.
referred to him as my husband,
mm-hmm.
and then corrected
caught
herself
and said, mm-hmm. yeah, as I was telling my husband, I mean the president the other day, and it was laughed off by spokesman for at the time she was National Security Advisor, so... That never went anywhere. People just kind of chalked it up to, well, you know, just little slip of the tongue there.
Mm-hmm.
But there are reports coming out of the Beltway that Mrs. Bush spent some time alone at the Mayflower Hotel within the last couple of weeks, mm-hmm. basically moving out of the White House. So, again, uncorroborated, and the White House press corps isn't reporting on it, mm-hmm. so we will leave it at that.
Well, and that story came out at the same time that Camp David meetings were starting. So,
mm-hmm.
frankly, President Bush wasn't in residence anyway. He and Condi Rice were at Camp David
mm-hmm.
at that time. So, I don't know. It could well be that something is going on. Oh, what a shock.
Mm-hmm. It's been reported by the Globe. Which cited Wayne Madsen of Wayne Madsen Report
mm-hmm.
as a source. And, of course, he is quoting sources at the Mayflower Hotel and elsewhere, intelligence sources and so forth. But we have to remember, you know, you can laugh at the Globe and say, oh, yeah, that's the Bat Boy. Well, no, actually, that's the Weekly World News has Bat Boy. But Globe did get it right on the Gary Rice, Donna Hart.
Yes.
Gary Hart, Donna Rice story and mm-hmm. Some other well-known celebrity peccadillos.
Well, and the fact is, I think sometimes you can diffuse a story by having it appear in the yellow press, so to speak.
Sure.
Then instantly, you know, quote unquote, legitimate journalists jump back and go, I'm not going there.
Can't touch that with a 10-foot pole.
No, because they're the ones that broke it first, and it might be a true story.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's in a, you know, a tabloid magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, also interesting, speaking of geopolitics, President Hu Jintao of China has been invited to the G8 conference. This is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
He's getting feted all over the place.
Well, they've got a lot of money to spend.
I know.
They've got to spend those wall bucks somewhere. And it's interesting that President Putin invited him.
He's the head of the G8 right now. The G8 is the G7 plus Russia.
Mm-hmm. And
they may become the G9. The 9.
That would be very interesting.
That would be very interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, not to get Peter Lavenda back on to talk about that.
Russia and China are developing some very close ties, and it looks like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is basically revolves around Russia and China, but which has extended invitations to India and Iran and mm-hmm. Afghanistan, looks to be turning into an anti-NATO.
Yes. Yeah, well, you can understand why. I mean, China is the up-and-comer. Mm-hmm. Russia is the, you know, he's the gas king,
mm-hmm.
Which I think there's a story in there today, which I think is really funny.
Turkmenistan.
Exactly. Thumbing their noses.
Yeah, turning the tables on Russia and demanding more money. We'll see how well that plays. the chumminess between Hu Jintao and Vladimir Putin is... it's big. It's mm-hmm. very big news. There have been conservatives all along who've always been suspicious of those two big communist nations anyway.
Like, I don't know. They don't protest know a lot about hating each other. I don't know.
But the invitation to the G8 is significant, especially as Putin at the press gathering with the two presidents today took a swipe at the United States and its military adventures in Central Asia. So a little bit of a message there sent at the press conference.
Well, if you're going to Scotland, folks, don't go whitewater rafting, especially if you have duct tape anywhere up on your person, because apparently outdoor activities are now suspicious.
In Scotland?
In Scotland, chief police officers are contacting outdoor activity groups following concerns that these groups could be used as organizational tools for terrorist training camps. This is because apparently two of the 7/7 London bombers had proof that they had attended a whitewater rafting expedition.
Scotland, where we're throwing like logs, is a sport?
Yes.
Being outdoors might be considered evidence that you're a terrorist?
If you're involved in any of these group activities outdoors.
That makes as much sense as the fact that in Canada, every spring, groups of young men go off to the woods with lots of beer and firearms, and have done so for the last, 300 years. And, you know, saying that the paintball 17 that were arrested up there.
Yes, that's a good way to put
it. Were possibly considered terrorists because they went off to the woods with firearms. Maybe they didn't have beer, you know, I don't know about that, but... And I make light of that. Again, we're not saying that these young men
weren't
up to something nefarious.
We're just saying that it's starting to be...
But when you look at the patterns of what's developing here, again, look at what they're saying fits a profile or may define the profile of a terrorist.
This guy's got tools in his garage and he went to a ball game.
He's got... yeah. Hello? You know, this person had batteries, duct tape, and a piece of a barbecue grill.
No!
And, you know, again, that sounds silly, but that was in the picture from the Toronto press conference.
I know it was. And I tell you what, there's so much stuff going on. We've had a listener who sent us some information. I'm trying to kind of piece it together in my own head. But apparently over in the UK, there's been this whole backlash about the arrests that were made a few weeks ago.
Right, which turned out to be based on flawed intelligence.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I didn't put the story on here today because the story that I found, I thought, was written unfairly.
Mm-hmm.
The gist of it is that a young man with below average intelligence is the source of some of the quote-unquote intelligence. But the person who wrote the piece used some very derogatory terms. And I just frankly didn't want to put it on our magazine. So
that's
even though the information was good, the way he wrote it I thought was hideous.
Mm.
Really slamming this kid. You know, I mean, you can imagine what words were used. But anyway, it just seems like a lot of things are happening to Tony Blair right now, including the Blair Force One, this plane that he apparently has paid out big bucks for, and the Queen's got one, too. And people are in an uproar about all of these millions of pounds that are being spent to make Blair look more presidential.
Hmm.
I know.
Well, yeah, he's had his own political troubles. It's kind of strange because as well-spoken and sophisticated as he appears and as cool under pressure as he appears, when we've seen him over here in the States, you know, even in those raucous, occasionally we'll see him on C-SPAN, the meetings that they have in the House of Commons there where he has to stand up and you get the guys on the two sides of the chamber there just shouting back and forth. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see the United States Congress go at it like that. I think that'd be great entertainment.
Oh, yeah.
But Prime Minister Blair always looks unflappable.
He's
always well-spoken. And our president, you know, we've said before, George Bush is not a dumb guy. He's an intelligent man. But by contrast to Tony Blair, he just looks like a backwater hick.
Well, you know, he was raised in a rural setting, even though he was raised with a silver spoon in his mouth.
That's true.
It had, you know, barbecue sauce on it.
Right. And I don't mean that as a slap against
people. No, I love that. I was raised in that kind of setting, too.
And my dad's family, my mom's family were farmers. My dad's family from, you know, rural Indiana. So, you know, I don't mean that to impugn anybody based on where they're from. It's just very strange for us to see Tony Blair, who always looks so cool and calm under pressure, and realize that he's doing just as badly politically as George Bush is over here. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting. There's a book that's been released that I think we're probably going to have to get if it's anything like this review.
Not another book. So many books to move.
I know. Those things are heavier than lead. The author's Ron Susskind. The book is called The 1% Doctrine. You might have heard about it. Washington Post reviewer named Barton Gellman posted a blurb about it over the weekend. And it's worth mentioning, a couple of years back, one of the early successes of the war in Iraq, the war on terror in Iraq, was the capture of a Saudi-born al-Qaeda detainee named Abu Zubaydah.
I remember the story.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, after he was captured, according to Gelman's review, his captors discovered that Abu Zubaydah was mentally ill. nothing like the pivotal figure they supposed him to be. And I'll quote now. CIA and FBI analysts poring over a diary he kept for more than a decade found entries, quote, in the voice of three people, Honey 1, Honey 2, and Honey 3, end quote. A boy, a young man, and a middle-aged alter ego. All three recorded in numbing detail, quote, what people ate or wore or trifling things they said, end quote. Dan Coleman, then the FBI's top Al-Qaeda analyst, told a senior bureau official, quote, this guy is insane, certifiable, split personality, end quote. Hmm. Now, we'll leave aside discussions of, you know, whether this guy was a program multiple for another show.
Yes.
But what happened, apparently, according to Gelman in his review of the book here, and what Susskind recorded in the 1% Doctrine, was that even though this information was reported back to the White House, President Bush went in front of the cameras and announced this major victory in the war on terror, that we'd gotten this Al-Qaeda mastermind, even though it was known to the Al-Qaeda specialists at the FBI and CIA that the guy was not all there. In fact, according to them, the only thing he was entrusted to do by Al-Qaeda was arrange for travel for wives and children of guys who were in the group. He got to take care of the family members. He didn't get to do any of the planning, operational planning for the families, the wives and the kids. He didn't get to do any of the operational planning. He was not in the loop. And yet, because the president had gone out and made this announcement, Bush said to CIA Director George Tenet, you're not going to let me lose face on this, are you? No, sir, Mr. President, Tenet replied. And so interrogators worked him over. They strapped Abu Zubaydah to a waterboard, which basically makes you think you're going to drown until they pull you back out. Mm-hmm. They withheld his medication. They bombarded him with deafening noise and harsh lights, deprived him of sleep. If you've read Peter Lavenda's Sinister Forces, you know that's how you
those
basically drive people insane.
Those are all things that are going to exacerbate his condition.
Exactly. And so, according to Susskind, under that duress, he began to speak of plots of every variety against shopping malls, banks, supermarkets, water systems, nuclear plants, apartment buildings, the Brooklyn Bridge, the Statue of Liberty, and with each new tale, thousands of uniformed men and women raced in a panic to each target. And so, Susskind writes, the United States tortured a mentally disturbed man and then leapt screaming at every word he uttered, end quote. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is the War on Terror.
Well, folks, the war on terror is just not going to end. If you think it is, just forget that. It's here forever.
Yeah, and it doesn't.
That's the whole point.
And exactly. And as we pointed out last night, it won't matter if we elect a Democrat in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to continue.
Right, because it's not a war on a region or a people. It's a war on an idea.
Mm-hmm. And the idea will just morph and shift. And there's a lot of money being made by those who are supplying the materiel and equipment to fight this war on this idea.
That is right. But there's good news on the horizon.
You saved a lot of money on your car insurance?
No, actually, I didn't do that. That would have been good. Didn't even have that duck drop by today. That was I kicked him out. I love duck. No, you can now drive by putting borscht into your tank.
Oh.
Beets, and the beat goes on.
Yeah.
There's a British Petroleum, BP, whatever they are calling themselves now.
Beet pee. Yeah.
Beet pee. They have decided beet peeing into darkness. That one's for you, Tom. Oh, well, anyway, we digress. Well, no, they have actually found a way to make a green fuel, like ethanol, from beets instead of using corn. You know, it's the sugar content that can convert to alcohol. So they're using sugar beets, I assume.
That's
so the price of sugar is probably going to go way up.
Yeah, well, I don't know how many sugar beets they grow in the UK, though, which is where I guess this
was. Well, I'm thinking over here, if somebody over here in the U.S., because BP is a big thing over here. They own a lot of stations over here. So if someone over in the U.S. says, hey, wait a minute, you know, up north in Dakotas, they grow beets up there.
Yeah, I know. Hey. My grandparents used to make wine out of that stuff.
Yeah.
Beet wine. That was good.
You can't beat it.
Well, before we beat you into submission with any more of these...
they've shut us off long ago, honey. Yeah. We can talk about whatever we want to. So, how about those Cubs?
No. That would be even worse. Too depressing. Let's not go there. We do have part two of our interview with Jerry E. Smith to get to. And things get more and more interesting as the further we get into the interview. We will talk a little bit more about what exactly this array might do and ways it might be used. And we turn to an expert, one who's researched this, because, well, we can't depend on DARPA to give us the full scoop.
No, they won't do it. So here's part two with Jerry E. Smith.
PID Radio continues with author Jerry E. Smith, whose book, HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, discusses what exactly is going on in Southeast Alaska with the world's largest AM radio transmitter. Jerry, welcome back to PID Radio.
Well, yes, good to be here. Actually, it's not an AM transmitter. It's a high-frequency transmitter. That's why it's called HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, is the field of antennas on the ground is a high-frequency transmitter, which is just below shortwave. It's in the audio band of the electromagnetic spectrum, but it's below the band that is used by voice radio communications.
Okay. See, now, I was in radio for a dozen years. I should have known that. So that shows you how much attention I paid to the technical side of the business. I guess the question that we have to ask, considering that the point of this appears to be to superheat the ionosphere in the upper atmosphere, is how this affects the weather.
Absolutely. One of the aspects of this from day one is, where did it begin? Whose idea is it? Why are they doing it? Mm-hmm. And there are some very confusing and odd answers to this. HARP has several official mentors. There are several different stories as to how HARP got started, who started it, and why, which may be why we don't know for sure whether or not it's weather warfare, because it may be intentionally hidden.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there are the several major most researchers are convinced that HARP is based on the patents that were created by Dr. Bernard Eastland and his crew while working for APTI. APTI was a wholly owned subsidiary of ARCO, the gas giant, and according to Bernard Eastland, his boss basically said, look, we got this problem with the North Slope oil field, because whenever you pump gas, whenever you pump oil, you also get gas, and we have all this gas here, and we cannot transport it anywhere, and there's nobody there to sell it to. So you come up with some way we can sell all this gas, because right now we're having to pump it back into the field, but we'd much rather pump in seawater to maintain pressure and sell the gas. So Eastland got this bright idea. Well, if you have this immense field of antennas, and his specifications were for a field of antennas 40 miles on a side.
Hmm.
HARP is only 1,000 feet by 1,200 feet on a side. So a little bit smaller.
Yeah.
Eastland's idea was that if you had this immense field, you could inject a tremendous amount of energy into the ionosphere and make it do things. And he described a number of things you could make it do, including weather manipulation. And weather control is an aspect of the Eastland patents. Now, of course, today, the HARP people say, oh, no, we're not the Eastland patents at all. That's not us. That's not what we're doing. And there are the evidence for them lying about it is that everyone who has had the project has had the patents. APTI early on bailed on the project and sold the patents to E-Systems. E-Systems got bought out by Raytheon. Raytheon then sold E-Systems to BAE Systems North America, the former British Aerospace.
Mm-hmm.
And with each change of hands, so the contract changed to whoever had those patents, which is proof that HARP is a unique patented ability to focus the firing of the antenna field to get the energy focused at the top of the atmosphere. Now, there are other claims and other official stories. One is, the weirdest one is from Ted Stevens, the senior senator from Alaska. He claims that professors from the University of Alaska trooped into his office one day and filled his head with wild stories of how they could harness the aurora. Now, the aurora is caused, it's a side effect of something called the electrojet. You know, the Earth is constantly being bombarded from the sun, from the solar wind, but with a variety of particles, and these get trapped in the upper atmosphere, and they get trapped in the magnetosphere, the Earth's magnetic field, and they spiral around the lines of magnetic force and bounce back and forth from the North Pole to the South Pole, working up a charge. And the Earth's magnetic field passing through the sun's magnetic field works like an electrical generator and also works up a tremendous charge. So that at any given point, there are millions of amperes of electricity flowing above the Earth. And this charge works up to the point where it has to discharge. It has to come in at the Earth, and it comes in at the poles, and it comes in so hot, so hard, so fast, it heats the atmosphere up, causing it to glow, to give off light. And this is the northern and southern lights, the aurora. And the University of Alaska guys wanted to harness the aurora, according to Ted Stevens. The Navy has a slightly different version of it, is that in order to broadcast in radio, you have to have your antenna has to be longer than the wave, than the signal you're broadcasting. And the lower the frequency, the longer the wave, to where if you want to broadcast at 10 hertz, you have to have an antenna 27,000 miles long. The Navy has been trying to make an antenna 27,000 miles long for 20 years. At 10 hertz, a radio signal will penetrate a couple of miles deep into the ocean. So if you have nuclear submarines hiding at just above their crush depth, they can still get a message, you know, go to DEFCON 4. Mm-hmm. And so it's been very important to the Navy to be able to do that. The Navy tried with Project Sanguine to put an antenna 27,000 miles long in Wisconsin. They were going to sew up Wisconsin like a shoelace and have an antenna about 2 feet deep back and forth across the whole length of the state. Huh. Well, the people in Wisconsin, of course, didn't buy it. They tried moving it to Michigan. The Michiganers wouldn't hear of it. They took it to Texas, and the Texans basically said, you know, we do things big in Texas, but not that big.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they ended up with an antenna about 300 miles long across the floor of one of the Great Lakes, and that's what they've been using to communicate with deeply submerged submarines, but it doesn't go anywhere near as deep as they want it to because they're not getting they're not generating ELF, they're generating VLF, very low frequency,
right,
which is close, but no cigar.
Yeah.
So what they wanted to do was to tune the aurora. They wanted to take the electrojet and tune it, turning it into a virtual antenna tens of thousands of miles long, so they could communicate with deeply submerged submarines. Now, as I say, the DARPA website, the Defense Advanced Projects Administration, took over HAARP in 2002 and just finished building the HAARP array this year. And on their website, they say that they have done exactly that. They say that they have used HAARP for the generation of extremely low-frequency, very low-frequency radio waves for submarine and other subsurface communications. Oddly enough, it's not mentioned on the official HAARP website. That done by the University of Alaska.
Mm. Yeah, I'm looking at the DARPA site right now, and that is point number one among the things that they believe they've accomplished with this device. Essentially, turning the atmosphere into a virtual antenna to communicate with submarines is their claim.
Yes, exactly. Point number two, the control of electron density gradients and the refractive properties in selected regions of the ionosphere to create radio wave propagation channels.
Mm-hmm.
You as a radio man probably understand that a whole lot better than I do. But what they've done is they've found that by injecting a tremendous amount of energy into the upper atmosphere, the upper atmosphere actually takes shape. Mm-hmm. It actually it's semi-solidifies, and they can create what they call striations. They can literally create tubes and tunnels in the atmosphere to bounce radio waves down. This may be a good thing. It may not be a good thing. I don't think there's ever been any environmental impact statement on what happens when you reshape the atmosphere.
Well, again, getting back to the environmental impact, is this then really for communications, or is this to manipulate what kind of weather patterns are affecting the United States or other countries in the world?
That's a very good point. And we don't know. Well, frankly, this is a technology that is quite literally more advanced than we are.
Have you seen the artifacts that came? You know, are you familiar with Mimic?
The site
out of Michigan. It's a site that keeps track of the hurricane activity, and they have satellite imagery that you can watch in real time, or almost real time. And if there are any odd signatures that show up, they will show up on Mimic. And we'll put a link to this in the show notes, by the way. It's a site that I go to during hurricane season almost every day. And I've been watching this depression that is now called Alberto through Mimic. The reason I ask about that is because last year during, was it Katrina?
Yeah.
Just before Katrina really heated up and headed for Louisiana, there was the strangest artifact that appeared right in the vicinity of that storm, and it was like fingers, as if somebody pressed their fingers down onto the atmosphere and made these, was it four little red?
Four or five, yeah.
Four, yeah, it was
little
the strangest shape. Thing.
And the
thinking being that it heated up the water around it and supercharged it.
There are a number of anomalies to Rita and Katrina and possibly Wilma.
Wilma was the other one I think we also saw with Wilma as well.
Yeah.
That was the one that just popped into Hurricane 5 overnight.
One of the sets of photos of NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, one set of six photos officially released by NOAA of Rita shows Rita with a square eye hole, which I found really, really amazing.
That just sounds impossible.
It does. It sounds impossible. I've looked at those photos dozens of times, and there definitely do appear to be corners. Now, of course, it could just be a trick of light or a stray puff of cloud or something. But
well, that could be, but there's also a photo that shows a number two.
Yes, I've seen the photo that shows the number two. Again, very odd. It looks to me like we have multiple. The reason why it's hard to figure out is there are multiple events taking place. There are a number of technologies that may be capable of steering hurricanes that may or may not exist. There is a Russian company that says that they can make hurricanes force winds to order, and they've been trying to sell this technology since the early 1990s. I believe that they did get a buyer for Gulf War II. Saddam Hussein bought himself a couple of weeks to dash undercover. Because, remember, our guys were all poised to go in. We had perfect weather. We launched, and an hour or three after we launched the attack, the worst winds, the worst sandstorms in a century came up.
Mm-hmm. I do remember that, yes.
Now, I believe that Saddam Hussein took the Russians up on it and bought himself an extra week of time by putting the Russian big wind technology to use. I can't prove it, of course. There have been a number of companies that are proposing to put up satellite power stations that they want to microwave and they want to put up big energy collectors, solar cells or whatever, out in space, and then from the satellite beam down energy to Earth in microwave format. And they, of course, have been talking about the microwave beam would be at such a frequency that it wouldn't interact with weather, wouldn't cause any weather, and would arrive at a point on Earth in a tight, confined space, and then they could be able to convert that into electricity, yada, yada. Well, there's a number of folks who have been saying, well, you know, if you could do that, if you up the frequency of the beam just a little bit, you could use it to heat the oceans. And if you can use it to heat the oceans, then you could use it to steer hurricanes with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's been discussed in Scientific American. Now, there was several articles in Scientific American over the last 10 years on how to do this. So I don't know if we actually have these power plants in space that could do this. But it's certainly, what you describe certainly sounds like the signature of such a thing being used.
Now, HARP, one of the other anomalies that was reported with the big hurricanes last year was the presence of lightning inside the canes. Normally, that only occurs inside thunderstorms where you get a lot of vertical winds, and the static charge that's built up by the winds rising and falling inside a supercell is what generates lightning. And we had a lot of it here in St. Louis last night.
Oh, we did.
But hurricanes are primarily lateral, horizontal winds. And so you don't generally get much in the way of lightning. But Katrina and Rita both generated as much lightning, according to NASA, as a big, you know, Oklahoma supercell.
Mm.
Would something like HARP be able to generate the kind of electric charge in the atmosphere that could lead to that sort of electrical discharge in a hurricane?
That's a technical question, and as we know, I don't do technical.
Okay.
But it made you sound really smart asking it, honey.
I have read some things similar to that. There's a couple of websites that monitor radar anomalies, and a couple of the guys who monitor these radar anomalies are now convinced that the weather radar actually interacts with the weather, that they're not just non-invasive spotting techniques, but actually by playing the radar energies on the atmosphere, they actually do change the electrical charges of the atmospheres. And if you have the radars lined up just right, you can direct the cells that they are showing.
Derek and I are looking at each other. I know we're thinking the same thing. Schrodinger's cat.
That's right.
Just by looking at the hurricane, you somehow change it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, let's go back then to the why of all of this. If, and we're speculating, HARP is some sort of an energy weapon designed to manipulate the atmosphere for weather purposes. Why would the United States government be interested in something like that?
Well, it goes back a very long way. In fact, it goes back to the very dawn of being human. Anybody who's ever fought a battle knows that the weather plays a role in the battle. The D-Day invasion of Normandy was touch and go because they had, you know, 100,000 men to put on the beach, and if there was a storm, they could lose all those amphibious craft. I mean, the guys could be all drowned before they got to the beach. Mm-hmm. So weather plays a key role, and the U.S. military have been actively working on manipulating the weather at least since Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
In Vietnam, there was Operation Popeye, which used cloud seeding over the Ho Chi Minh Trail to try and extend the monsoon season so as to turn the Ho Chi Minh Trail into an impassable quagmire so that the Viet Cong could not get resupplied.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the war, the U.S. Air Force flatly stated that weather manipulation is not a tool of war that we wish to use. And I don't think anybody has ever believed that statement.
Well, you know, it's what's really horrific is that it actually could be used for other things, too. Okay, we're going to keep rain from hitting your country for the next 5 weeks, and therefore your winter wheat is not going to be worth a dime. Oh, hey, we've got some winter wheat. Want to buy it? Oh,
yeah,
but
there
if you,
you
want
go.
Our winter wheat, you're going to have to play ball.
Yep, that has been discussed at the very highest levels of the U.S. government since the 1960s. Dr. Gordon J.F. McDonald, who was one of the top scientists in this country and one of the top military advisors, openly talked about how in the next few years that the politicians would have at their disposal the ability to conduct covert war against their enemies, and that they could indeed engage in biological terrorism or weather terrorism and compel other countries to do their bidding with only a few people in the military having any clue that was going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is one aspect of HAARP that is disturbing enough, but tomorrow we will get into a perhaps an even more unsettling application for HAARP as we continue our discussion with Jerry E. Smith, the author of HAARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, tomorrow on PID Radio.
And Jerry's website is www.jerryesmith.com. That's Jerry with a J, Smith with an I. And he'll also have information about his book about the secrets of the Holy Lance, or the Spear of Destiny, as it's sometimes
mm-hmm.
called.
Yeah, it's got a couple of different titles. Same book, just mm-hmm. I think they switched the title. And we'll, of course, have part three tomorrow evening.
That's right.
This is Wednesday. Yeah, I've lost track of the week somehow. We just want to give you a heads up. PID Radio may be kind of shifting the times that we're available. We're not really sure how this is going to work, but as we get into the big time activity of packing and mm-hmm. cleaning and prepping the house putting it on sale, we may have less and less time
yep.
to do this on a nightly basis during the week. So we're praying about it, and we hope that you'll pray about it along with us and help us to decide how best we can still be here for you, bring the interviews that mm-hmm. we've scheduled. There's some terrific interviews coming up this weekend. We're going to be speaking with Eric John Phelps and the Frog Brothers.
Yes, Philip Collins and Paul Collins. And we also have interviews tentatively scheduled with Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin and also Chris Milligan to talk about Colonel Marvin's experiences not only in Vietnam as a Special Forces soldier, a Green Beret, but
Milligan's going to talk about Skull and Bones.
We're going to talk about Skull and Bones with Chris Milligan. So some very interesting things. But the fact is that with a house to prepare for selling, a move, and a new job to begin, we really can't project what our time is going to, how much time we're going to have available to us for the next 8 weeks or so.
That's right. We're going to have to actually clear out the bunker.
Yeah.
And repaint the floor and various things to get the house ready for sale. So it's going to be tough when things are packed away to do the show every night. So
right.
we may go to once a week for a while just to see how things go. But again, not to scare anybody. Or actually, you may be out there applauding right now. Yes, finally, my prayers have been answered.
That's right. Well, we will give you a heads up. Don't fear. We'll have programs for Thursday night and Friday night of this week. And then beginning next week, we may go to a reduced schedule. We may go to a weekly schedule as
yeah.
the weeks come out, as the weeks go forward, but we
yeah.
will let you know in advance.
And I will be gone tomorrow, so Derek will be wrapping things up.
Yes.
Here in the bunker.
Blathering and ranting all by myself.
I know. Oh, well, he'll have Murphy because he'll still be here.
That's right.
We are delivering Java to her new home tomorrow mm-hmm. morning, and she's going to be very, very happy.
Yep.
Yep. And we're still looking for Murphy, but we know that that's going to work out because we've got several people who are considering right now. He's,
yep.
he's a lovely, lovely dog.
Yes,
handsome
he is.
Dog.
Yes, and rugged. Ruggedly handsome.
Ruggedly handsome, yes.
And ferocious. Chief of Security Murphy, yes.
Yeah, actually at his age, he's starting to get where he naps a lot. Naps most of the time. Well, so do I.
Yeah, well, he's good for that. He's good for that. Well, part three of our interview, conclusion of our discussion with Jerry E. Smith tomorrow night. And again, look forward next week to Peter Lavenda's discussion of the Nazi the occult roots of the Nazi Party.
You
that
know,
is really educational.
I am so looking forward to that interview. Because as I told you, I had a dream last night. I keep dreaming about Germany and Nazis. I'm planning to write a book based on these dreams. So look for that in the future.
Yes, and it will be a little more, let's say, intense than, say, Springtime for Hitler. We watched the producers, the old version and the new version.
The new version
over the weekend.
Is better.
It really is. Mel Brooks, some of his movies, you know, weren't quite as funny as others. You know, some of them were just a little silly. But I've got to say, the producers with Zero Mustache and Gene
silly.
Wilder.
They're all silly except for one.
Well, that's true. That's true. I was really surprised to find out that he's the guy who produced The Elephant Man.
I know. That's
with,
the one that's
Anthony
not
Hopkins.
Silly. Exactly.
Yeah. And that's why he kept his name off of that movie so that no one would know. But, no, the producers was brilliant. But the musical version
the new version is so
amazing.
Really funny.
Yeah.
And they're both, they really are gay romps. Mel Brooks is in your face with it. And I think what he's really slamming the whole Hollywood notion that everybody there is gay.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can just get past that and just sit and enjoy it, the music's funny. It's just great shtick. It's
yeah.
old-time comedy.
Well, and Nathan Lane is amazing. Zero Mostel was one of my favorite actors.
Uh-huh.
Peter Ustinov is another who could have done that role. But anyway, Nathan Lane does as fine a job as Zero Mostel did in that role. It's just amazing. So anyway, that's...
Well, we digress. We do. Do we? We never have. Well, folks, if you haven't made that hat yet... Get out that aluminum foil and begin to construct.
That's right. We're looking for recruits for the Illuminati.
I'm sure some of you out there have engineering degrees.
Mm-hmm.
We expect much from you.
And there are some we know who have advanced degrees in mathematics, and we're expecting some very precise designs there.
And
angles
some...
carefully calculated.
Yes, exactly. Okay, if angle B is... And some of you are artistic. In nature. In fact, some of you make your living in the arts, graphic arts, and we expect very, very much from you. So in the categories of the funniest, the most original, and the most high tech.
That's right. And we will be soliciting your entries until the end of July, July 30th.
31st. There are 31 days in July.
That's right, there are.
That's right. Oh, rats.
That throws off all my...
No, it's 9/11 times. If you missed the opening cut to last night's show, the opening clip, listen to it again.
Yeah, it was...
It's one of my favorites.
That was pretty clever. Well, yeah, so get us those digital photos of the of your entry for the aluminum tinfoil head contest.
To join the Illuminati.
Yes, we'll take tinfoil or aluminum foil that looks like tinfoil. Either way.
You know, once we get settled in the new place, what I would like to do, seriously, is get one of those laminating machines.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll make up Illuminati cards.
There you go. So you can be a card-carrying member. That's brilliant.
That's right. Well, we'll work on that.
But send those digital photos to our email address, which is radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
And come join us at the forum and bring a cake or a pie. Mostly pies, because they are square. And you can get there by going to peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
And until tomorrow, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody. Bye-bye.
This is PID Radio.